Hello, my name is Matthew Kidman, and welcome to the latest episode of Success and More Interesting Stuff, brought to you by Livewire Markets. Affordable housing seems to be an elusive goal in Australia. However, Lifestyle Communities, which is celebrating its 21st birthday in 2024, might have just cracked the code. The company's land rent model is spreading across Victoria at an ever-increasing rate. To date, more than 30 villages within driving distance of Melbourne have been built or are in the planning stages. In total, more than 5,700 homeowners have been accommodated, with many more to come. Lifestyle Communities started life modestly. At the helm was property veteran James Kelly, ably assisted by his partners Bruce Carter and Dale Perloff. The company listed on the ASX 4 years later, quietly backdooring into a listed cash box. Over the next 17 years, only the insiders and some unsuspecting investors have enjoyed the stunning 2,500% return. Today, the company has a market value of over $1.7 billion. Like most successful businesses, the original idea was a simple one. Make housing affordable for empty nesters in their late 50s and early 60s. Sell your home and move into a brand new village community. Buy the home and rent the land, having enough capital left over to live a comfortable life. Today, Kelly, at 64 years of age, is a prime candidate to be a Lifestyle Communities customer. I get the feeling, though, he is still happy to keep the accelerator to the floor. I first met James not long after the company listed on the ASX in 2006. He has always been an engaging, upbeat individual, defying the typecast property developer image. Welcome, James, and happy 21st birthday.
Thank you, Matthew.
It's been a busy one.
It has been indeed. So, and a very busy year to have a 21st birthday in. So,
yeah. And I'm right, it's 21.
It's 21 years.
So it's an adult now.
We've grown up indeed. So Dale, Bruce and I met in a cafe in Malvern on the 24th of February, 2003, and that's where the whole idea started. So, which was an exciting time.
Definitely, and we'll get to that because I'm interested in how you actually thought of the concept. What is interesting also that you're on a roadshow, you're doing your profit results, you've had an unusual capital raising.
Yep.
And quite a bit. It's been a big couple of weeks, and I'm glad you could fit us in to have a chat.
Pleasure.
So let's go back to that. I'm interested about that cafe. What brought that on? Whose idea was it? And because it's been a model that's sustained for more than a couple of decades now.
I knew Bruce through old friendships and almost from, you know, joint friends at school. He had sort of stepped down for a big role at Pracom, which had been one of those dot darlings and dot bombs.
But it still taken over in the end.
It got relisted. It got changed the name to Nambri.
Pracom sold out.
So that was Nambri. So that was known to us. He knew a guy called Dale Perloff, who was a he was in out of the tech industry as well, sort of telephone industry as well, and he had thought about the idea of doing affordable backpacking accommodation for grey nomads, saying the backpackers didn't want to sleep in a bunk room with 22-year-olds. I think he was pretty right on that. And then kind of we met at the cafe, and the idea, I guess, for the business came a little bit from some of the experience when I was MD at Dennis Family Corporation.
So you were the only property person?
I was the only property person. They were two telcos. Bruce, a finance wizard, and Dale, an operational guru. So it was kind of a meeting of minds, and I brought the property development side and probably a bit of the marketing and people side of the business as well.
And how long was it you who thought of the idea? Let's start a new company and you were roping them along, or who was the coercer?
I think great ideas have lots of owners and bad ideas are orphans, but it was kind of a collective. But I guess it came a little bit from my experience when I was CEO of Dennis Family Corporation and then looking at, in the outer burbs, what was available for people to downsize. And I remember Cranbourne, Dennis Family Corporation, were doing a joint venture with a retirement village group, and they were selling homes for $300,000 when prices in Cranbourne at the time, average median home price was $267,000. So I remember saying to myself, gosh.
That doesn't work.
That doesn't work. Where do these people go? And the response was nowhere. There's just no product being built for people in the outer burbs of Melbourne and regional Victoria where they could actually downsize, free up cash and live a better life. So that was the sort of genesis of the idea.
And who came up with the concept that you might be able to separate the land from the building?
So the manufactured home concept had been alive and well for a while in New South Wales and Queensland. So when we went exploring to try and find a model that could deliver that, we stumbled across this land lease community style, and that sort of triggered some ideas around how we could also map our way through the various other imposts that go with properties such as stamp duty and those sort of things. So the model we developed in Victoria was really probably quite unique in Australia in terms of the way we approach that. I think in a way, you know, the other part of our mandate was to be ethically, morally and socially responsible. That was always sort of in our DNA when thinking about it. So,
because the industry, and it's a broad industry because there's all different levels. There's obviously retirement homes, there's nursing homes. So I'm talking about for the older age group.
Yes.
Yours fits in at the start of that where it's obviously, as you said, it's the empty nesters, or I said it in the introduction.
Yes.
It didn't have a great reputation.
No, it didn't. And we actually looked at the care continuum. And for us, you know, at zero care in the risk profile, it was next to zero. And then as you go up the care continuum, there was just increased added risk from legislation. At the time when we also were starting, there'd been a big retrospective legislation on fire service in aged care. And that really spooked the industry, caused a lot of aged care homes to close down because they didn't have sprinklers or fire hydrants and other things that were forced to be retrofitted. And so we had this aha moment where we went, wow, you know, the higher up the aged care you go, the more normalised the results are, but equally the higher the legislative risk in terms of things might change. So we went with sort of the zero care, not that we don't care, but we don't provide care model of just pure independent living.
And thinking, for slightly younger people who were looking.
Correct, yeah, much more active community. So the idea was around, the young at heart who sort of didn't think of themselves as retiring, but rather rewiring and sort of now starting their next adventure. And that was sort of the absolute, you know, sort of from the get-go, our sort of target customer and how we approached the market. Did a lot of focus groups, which is really interesting.
And did it fire from day one?
It did fire from day one, which is interesting, Matthew, because on the operational side, selling homes fired from day one. On the capital side, that was a bit messier because we went to the top five banks and they just had never heard of what we were talking about and basically showed us the door. They went, you know, don't know what you're talking about. You know, whether they buy the land, lease the house, whether they lease the chimney and buy the window. I don't get it at all. And we just failed at that point. And they really just said, no, don't get it at all. And then we got Investec, a South African bank, to come on board.
And how many meetings to get that?
A lot. They had
that your 90th meeting or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Correct. It was a really long process for them to take them through what it all meant. But they had an entrepreneurial spirit as much as we did, saying, this is an interesting sector. We then did a friends and family raise where we passed the hat around, raised $3.6 million, most of which came from my friends and family because for Dale and Bruce, they were going around amongst their friends saying, we want to raise capital to do a property development. They all turned around, all their friends turned around and said, what the hell would you know about doing a property development? So
that's a fair comment.
That was a very fair comment. So they raised not much. But so we had a friends and family raise of $3.6 million, promised them 20% returns, which we ultimately delivered, and went to invest and got a non-recourse loan from them, which to this day I'm still staggered they made it non-recourse. And that
was a big effort from them because I'm thinking back a few years before that in the listed market, names like Ted Cent,
yes,
you know, reverberated through that period. And anyone who was doing anything for accommodation in the aged sector, as you said, independent living, had a bit of a, I hate to say it, but had a bit of a smell about it. No
yes.
one really trusted the whole structure. It wasn't just Ted. There were other players. I remember there was one that went broke at the time, Prime Life.
Prime Life, that's right.
That went broke.
Yep.
That was another version.
Yep.
So for investors on our side, and you talk about Investec, it was hard to get our minds around.
I totally agree with you. And interestingly enough, just a quick roll forward, I was reflecting back as we did this equity raise on Thursday. When I started the equity raise back in 2012, I rolled into our first investor. And they said to me, if you say the word retirement or retirement village in the next 30 seconds, this meeting's at an end. It was the level of suspicion around that that asset class. And you're right, it had been coloured significantly by some of the previous operators that had given it really a pretty bad name. It also grew up in the 90s on 150% tax deduction and a whole range of different sort of opportunities which really got exploited by sort of not really to look after people but more around trying to, you know, drive a development profit out of it. So, you know, it's one of those industries that probably started really with not-for-profit and then got commercialised. Property developers came in and sort of, you know, it's really been struggling ever since, you know, particularly the last 5 years after that Four Corners program sort of was probably in a way the sort of the death knell, I think, of that asset class going forward.
Yeah. I think we're growing up a bit though now.
True.
We got used to it. People moving into whatever village it is, they kind of understand a bit more now what they're investing in and how they'll live.
So. Plus, it's a different customer base now. It's you know, when we started, it was the war generation. They were hard to shift. You know, they were moving
the silent generation,
the war generation, and the silent generation. Exactly, Matthew. So, they were you know, very much negative trigger buyers. You know, they were moving for fear, uncertainty, and all those sort of reasons, and safety. And then we met the baby boom gen in 2013, and they were moving for reasons of downsize for our cash. And now we've met the Gen X. And so, really, the old form of a retirement village doesn't really meet the sort of baby boom Gen X desire for what they want to do, nor does that model in terms of stepping rights to refurb and huge exit fees is now not ticking the box of that group anymore. So the model sort of, I think, slowly making its way to either being transformed into something else or repurposed.
But I think the, and to finish up on this a little bit so we can go back and talk about where it all came from, but I think the other thing is that the actual accommodation, looking at the product that you deliver and some of the others now, is far superior to what it used to be.
Very true.
And people have a desire to group together.
It's very true.
To live in those villages, you know, like interests, like stages in life. It's just the peer group, I think, and that's a big driver, I would have thought.
I totally agree with you, Matthew, and I think that people's natural want to commune and be part of something and to belong to something is very a big part of purpose. And so we see that a lot, particularly in single female. 50% of our customers are single female. And they very much relate to what our new communities offer. And as you say, also what we offer in our facilities and our clubhouses, a much higher level of offer and aspiration than perhaps has been previously offered. So the land lease industry sort of has been coming of age over time, and now, you know, it's great to see Stockland, Mervac and others sort of enter the fray, because that's going to really, you know, increase the push of this sector into that addressable market in education so that people actually know what this land lease industry actually offers. Because I think you're right, you know, people's need to be part of something is a really driving factor. And I think particularly as also relationships have got more commoditized and digitized through, you know, the digital age, it's made people want to connect more, I think, as well, in a physical sense.
I think it's important for society in general.
Yep.
I mean, that's what people are longing. So eventually it's kind of got there, I think.
I think you're right.
Let's go back, because when I was doing, obviously I've known you for quite a while, but when I was looking for stuff, there's not much out there. You do a few ads for lifestyle communities, but there's a bit of a mystery behind that.
Yes.
In terms of not much information. But you grew up in Melbourne?
I did indeed. And look, I grew up in a good suburb, went to a good school, but even though my family had money to a point, we lived a reasonable sort of humble lifestyle in the sense my father was a doctor, both grandfathers were doctors. And my two brothers end up being doctors, so having a businessman amongst that was...
So you're the disappointment, eh?
I'm the disappointment, exactly. So, but we were always a very caring family. We were always looked out for people, and it was sort of that care component of my upbringing that sort of led me into this space, I guess, as well. And I think that part of what lifestyle is in terms of being homeowner and customer-centric has been probably able to biggest point of differentiation. I do reflect back on where I started and the way I thought about things then, and that has carried through a lot in the culture of lifestyle and how Bruce Dale and I thought when we set it up originally. So yeah, it's a a very frustrating beginning in a sense that my father thought businessmen, he used to go to his club or wherever that was and his groups, and the businessmen were always sort of taking another 4 weeks off, and he was a doctor working, you know, on 15-minute shifts with patients and going...
He had the wrong business model.
100%. And so it was sort of like he always thought businessmen were, you know, just... It was just so easy to be a businessman, and he never really understood the journey of what a businessman is.
But if I remember correctly, though, he invested in shares.
He did. So he backed, I'll give him credit. When I first started, I did a property group at Melbourne University, and then I started with Costain Australia, and then went to this sort of a small architecture practice that was designing a building I was working on, and we're doing sort of two-story walk-up developments and all the rest of it. I remember I sold him a building that we developed in High Street Kew, the post office in High Street Kew in Melbourne.
And you sold it to your dad?
Yeah.
Right.
So that was a big move, Matthew. Like, and then we went immediately into a huge property crash, and my father would never... let me forget that I'd sold him a building in High Street Kew, but he was good. He got it. He backed it. He always backed each of I was one of five, so he backed each of us in terms of what our aspirations were and hopes and dreams were. So
did he hold on to that asset?
I actually inherited it recently when he died,
right. Okay.
And the asset's still there. So I bought it.
I'm
back.
I'm sure it's worth more today.
I bought it back from the estate. Yes, it is indeed. It's a great asset.
Oh, and sentimental, no doubt.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, so from that, I gather that you're always, from the day you left school into your post-school studies, your tertiary studies, it was property.
Always
what
property.
What intrigued you about property? Because us and the rest of the listeners out there, we all like shares.
Yes, yes.
But property's been a great way to make money in Australia.
I love
to build your wealth.
I love developing property because, one, it was an expression of you, and two, it was a lasting legacy. I still love the fact that I can drive down St Kilda Road. And the first project I was really purely involved in, working for Costain Australia as a project manager, was in St Kilda Road. It's called the Kingston Building. I look at it every time I drive past that, I go, wow, I helped create that. And I think that's the thing that's always intrigued me about property, is that you do create a legacy, and it needs thought, it needs care, it needs insight. And then when you can bring it together... you get this fantastic outcome. So
it's a nice legacy. Is there anything you drive past and you go, gosh, I wish I didn't
know? Oh, my God, there is lots. There's when in the two-story walk-up market, Matthew, in the 80s, in that sort of property boom in the 80s before it all crashed, yeah, there's a building I won't say where it is because every time someone drives past it will go, that's the thing that Kelly did, crikey. Yeah, there's a few things I'm not so proud of, but 90% of what I've done I've always been proud of. And, without doubt, you know, I think my proudest legacy will be lifestyle community. So,
no doubt. And you always seem to have it seems like you had an affinity to it. You're good at property development.
Yeah.
You understood it. You knew what people required.
Yes, exactly. And I think that, to this day, Matthew, the number of buildings I see built where they just had no idea who their customer was or who they were building it for, just I have to shake my head. You know, everything I've done, you know, it's always gone customer first. So, I think that's the thing where I see so much of property fail, where they just haven't done the simple exercise of sitting down with the customer base and saying, you know, what are we trying to create here?
And that's the key.
That's the key, 100%, yeah.
It's got to be in demand.
Yeah.
Just to finish up on your family, what was it like when you all got together? They were all talking medical.
Yes.
Did you ever get into the conversation? Was anyone in the family interested in what you were doing?
Well, I'm nearly a dermatologist, I want to say that. So, Matthew, if you've got any skin rashes, just ask me. I'm nearly a dermatologist. So they're all dermatologists. So I'm,
right. Oh, okay.
From listening to them, listening to them every dinner time talking about dermatology. In later years, I think they actually flipped because, in a way, you know, for a doctor's life, you know, they're sitting there, you know, welded to the medical practice, seeing a patient every 15 minutes, you know, often they're just the worried are well and... Well, I've got this opportunity to actually, you know, use my time totally differently, get out and about and create things but not be welded to a desk. So I think my brothers actually look at me now and go, oh, that's an interesting career. In fact, my oldest brother's son, who's also James Kelly, is in the property industry and looking at what I'm doing and sort of trying to work out how could he replicate in a different way of starting a business in the property industry. So, yeah, one nephew did follow me.
You've won them over. So what happened then? You're talking about there when you started working and you were developing these buildings. Just give us a quick kind of history of where you worked and how you got to the Dennis family.
Yeah, so
because that was obviously a big job for you.
So a really quick resume on that. Did property and park commerce at Melbourne University. Left the commerce tree early because I just got bored with it, I think. Started with Costa in Australia. The last bit I worked on the Kingston Towers, they had some architects. They asked me to come and join them. We started doing property development together in the 80s. We made a monster and lost a monster.
And was that the hardest period, the early 90s when
we lost
it all. The economy went into that horrible recession.
About 89 when interest rates were up around 18% and 21%.
Because Melbourne was the worst of it.
It was. We were, I think, much more bullish around what could happen. I think the warning signs weren't as clearly seen from the Melbourne perspective as perhaps other capital cities. And I then went to Lendlease and worked there for three tough years, I've got to say. That had a very misogynistic, sort of tough culture, and it was all sort of table banging and all the rest of it, and I didn't enjoy that and much at all, and sort of left there. I was going to do an MBA at Melbourne and got into it and bought all the books, and then my Grace brothers at the time were parachuting in 10 people at a GM level to change the strategic thinking in the retail, because in retailers, most people basically succession off the shop floor. And so, but they're all very reactive. Like, you know, they, you know, within 1 second you could be, you know, putting prices up. Next second you'd be putting in markdowns. So they were trying to get longevity and tenor into thinking. So I started there looking after the property group. And then after about 3 years, I actually started looking after a retail business, which was really interesting. Sort of way out of my but one, probably the three most fascinating years I had.
Were you a good retailer?
Good question, Matthew. What I loved about retail was the customer service aspect, and that's what really taught me how to listen to customers and how to modify service for customers. I looked after all the peripheral businesses, such as menswear, men's formal, hire, my cleaning, because all the food halls, all confectionery, that was kind of my business unit. I don't think I was particularly good at it. But what I was good at was high curiosity and own it, sort it. So, I realised that, you know, really it was a highly operational environment. How to actually shift that to a more strategic environment was a real challenge for all retailers. And I think I realised that I was, you know, I was dealing with, we had nine other business leaders and they were all very operationally focused. And I found it very, very frustrating of how to get them to think, you know, longer term. And that I guess was a bit my frustration from there.
But that would have helped your management skills, which
100%
over the last decade or two has been critical given the size of the business you built.
Yeah, really good point. In fact, when I was talked out of doing the MBA by the head of retail at my Grace Brothers, he said, it was Frank Whitford, and he said, we'll give you a better experience at Myer than you'll ever get through an MBA because you'll get to lead large groups of people. And so in my team at the end in confectionery, food hall and all the rest, it was about 3,000 people. So it does, retail
big
gives
business.
You, it's a big business, sort of turned over about 350 million, 400 million back then. So it does allow you that opportunity to sort of lead large groups and have an influence and develop your leadership skills. And that's what really then set me up for Dennis Family Corporation to become the sort of first external MD on a 40-year-long family business. And
it sounds like a hornet's nest going in there. They must have liked you.
I remember I was influenced by the whole board. I was interviewed by the whole board, and they said to me, what are you going to do on your first day? And I said, well, I won't be here. I'm going to be out there because I've got to learn your business. And from there, that was very much my journey of sort of empower the business to be able to get on and do what they do. And Bert Dennis to this day is probably one of my greatest mentors in terms of understanding property and understanding particularly land development. But that really honed my skills in leadership, in strategic thinking, in also empowering people. I think that was the biggest thing I learned. And the business went from like 130 million to about 340 million over 3 years, and we became the second largest home builder in Australia. And those, what I learned through that process also was absolutely critical for them when I went forward to start up Lifestyle Communities.
In terms of how to coordinate the whole process?
Correct.
Because there's a lot of stakeholders.
Correct. And I think, you know, land development and home building is such a fascinating sort of area to be involved in. If you went through university, no one ever talked about home building or land subdivision. It was all about high-rise residential, high-rise commercial or retail shopping centres. But when you can get to actually subdivide land and create something on it, you know, there's just nothing more exciting. So I was really hooked through Dan's family on particularly, again, back into the consumer piece of understanding what customers wanted in a home and how you then match that need with the home designs that you do, and making sure your displays were absolutely on point, they were furnished correctly. And that's a lot of things that we changed within Dennis that then drove that success.
And what did Bert teach you? Was it Bert Dennis you said?
Bert Dennis.
Yeah.
He taught me about really pricing risk. That's what he taught me. I didn't really understand risk and how to price risk in those days. And so he taught me how to actually look at cycles, understand how markets move, price things appropriately so you've got sufficient buffer to take in down, you know, when things cycle down or cycle up, and to think very long term. That was Bert's greatest gift to me. Also, you know, he had a hustle about him as well, which I just loved, and he had a absolutely ferocious intellect and curiosity, and which I just so enjoyed being a part of, and kind of honed my thinking around how you value land, how you value opportunities, how you select sites, and then how you bring into play housing, match that out, but also mitigate risk as you go through in terms of what you spend, how you spend it, where you spend it, and making sure that you're always keeping, you know, gearing and peak debt and everything sort of under control. And that's what, yeah, that's what Bert taught me.
It's interesting you say that, because I don't think a lot of people who go into business think about how do I price risk.
Yes.
It's a bit of a foreign concept. We're all doing it if we're in business. But to actually articulate that and have a approach to it is rare, I would say, and why a lot of small businesses don't make it.
I totally agree with you, Matthew. And I think that's the, you know, again, greatest gift he gave me. I totally agree. I just see... you know, you get in a sort of fortunate position when you get to my stage of seeing lots of other business ideas come across your desk that people are putting up to say, and would I be interested in funding them? And, you know, that risk delta, I just never see. I'm pricing it in, but they're not pricing it in. So, I think that's the, one of the key things. The other thing I also lay over this is, yeah, I actually got this from the ABC a long time ago. It was a program I was listening to. They gave us three things. They said, three things you've got to look at with a new business. Firstly, what's the problem you're trying to solve? Because if you're not trying to solve a problem for anything, then don't start the business. There's got to be a
you're
problem
not relevant,
first.
Then.
Correct.
Yep.
And then the next thing was, who are you solving it for? Yeah. So you go, yeah, I've solved the problem, but who actually wants the problem solved? And then finally, the biggest question is, will they pay for it? And I think so many businesses I see, they've kind of sorted out one of those or two of those, but they've not sorted out three of those. And so unless you know the problem you're trying to solve, unless you know who you're solving it for, unless you know they'll actually pay for the solution, then it's not going to be much of a business. And I reflect back on lifestyle communities and go, yeah, I think we ticked those boxes really clearly. We knew there was a problem in affordable housing for over 50s. We knew that the people we were solving it for was, you know, people over 55 who were living in the outer suburbs of Melbourne and blah, blah. And will they pay for it? Yeah, as long as you priced it at 80% of the median house price, happy days, they could downsize and free up cash. So
bingo.
You kind of tick those boxes. Bingo, correct.
So let's go to that cafe in 2003. You leave a very good job, one that must be hard, but talk about risk. You're in your 40s and you step out and say, we can do this ourselves. How did you feel at the time? Excited or feeling a little bit gooey in the stomach?
I'd always wanted to start a business, always wanted to run a business. And so, it was exciting once we started to find finance. I think it was gooey before that. We kind of thought the banks would pick this up and sort of get it. We saw it as such a good option. You know, we went up and down the east coast of Australia and went over to America and sort of came back saying, we've got it. You know, bingo, this model, awesome. And when we pitched it, though, the banks all went, I don't get it. You go, but no, you know, sort of doors closed. You know, obviously a very different story now, but back then, it was very hard to get traction.
No one else in Australia was, or Victoria, where you're based, was really doing it?
I think no one was doing it there were property developers doing it in other states, making big development profits. But when we went to the banks to say, we're not going to make a development profit or cash profit building the community. They just could not get it. They could not get that through their models.
So fill out, while we're here, fill out that model for us. So develop the building, so break even.
So yes, our model is basically we build a community. We don't make a cash profit at all. So the first dollar we put in is the last dollar we get out. Then our business is all about the long-term management, collecting the resort fee that we charge per week on living in the community, and then the deferred management fee that we charge when they move out. So that's our only income stream. And that only happened because Dale and Bruce were from a telephone background. And when we looked down to look at our first site, I had, you know, dollars in my eyes and went, okay, this is going to be fantastic. We can make $50,000 per home as a development profit. And then we could lie on a beach. That's $11 million, $3 million each. Brilliant. and they turned around completely shocked and said, no, this is an annuity business. It's not, you know, you give the phone away to get the annuity income stream. And we want our capital back really quickly.
That's smart. People coming from another industry.
Yeah. It was really good. So that's been the model ever since and sort of driven it. But when you put that in front of a bank to say there is no profit in building it, they just could not understand that. That was just a total anathema to them. They were saying, no, you need to make a big development profit and we need to have payback on the first line of debt, you know, blah, blah, you know, within the first stage. And we're saying, no, we don't make a profit. We don't get all our cash back till the very end. They're going, no, that's not going to work. We need the cash back, you know, 50% of the cash back in the first stage. It just didn't work that way. So
you hook Investec.
We hooked Investec.
And what was the first project?
Brookfield. We always thought that if we could make Brookfield work out at
so
Melton,
you
could make
it work anywhere. For all our listeners, where is Brookfield?
It's in the mighty west of Melbourne. So Brookfield's in a suburb called Melton. There's always this thing it was a tough suburb, Melton. The harder part of the west economically. It was pretty isolated, very blue collar, a bit of unemployment. And we thought we'd manage to get some land quite cheaply, actually, to get us going and could get 230 homes on it. So, yeah, that kind of launched the first one. And then
do you remember the numbers around that? How much did the land cost you?
100%, $1.3 million for the land. And we were selling homes from $120,000 to $160,000. And I remember we thought at the time, gosh, I wonder if we'll ever sell a home for $200,000. We recently sold a home down in the Bellarine for $1 million. So
we've
come a long way. So, yeah, a long way from that.
So the people in Melton were selling their homes that they'd lived in for around $200,000, were they?
Correct. $230,000 was the average house price in Melton when we were there.
They were selling that, buying into the community.
Yep.
Under the structure where they'd buy the house, rent the land, and it would cost them
about $145,000 average.
And the difference they would keep?
$55,000, absolute fortune.
And how did that go?
Brilliantly. We
saw you were off and running.
We were off and running, except the local building surveyor didn't understand the model, so we built our first 9 homes and we didn't need a building permit. He gave us a demolition order for the first 9 homes. That's when I had a soggy moment, I've got to say, because suddenly our first 9 homes were going to be demolished. And so we took them to the Building Appeals Board and we were 100% successful and kind of proofed up the model in Victoria to say, this is how you do it, this is how you attack it, this is what you need. And it's a kind of a precedent case now that sort of long since died because the model's so familiar now. But, you know, if any council said you need building permits, we go, no, that's the precedent case. So a bit of a rocky start, then opened the clubhouse. Homeowners kept moving in.
And at that point, while they were selling and you were feeling better about the world and were you thinking we can do this again and again?
Yes.
Was there ambition at that stage?
There was. So, you know, we all came from a corporate life, and when we started Lifestyle, we all said we were corporate refugees, you know, to make the culture never like a corporate again. But we also, there was that desire to go bigger, not for the sake of ego, but rather for the sake of, you know, we could actually roll this out again and again. And I think that model works. So we're just as intrigued to see whether it would work. We kind of never really wanted to be, the idea was never to be too big. It was just to sort of do this and have a good life balance. But kind of things got so interesting and intriguing and curiosity peaked. By 2007, we completely ran out of cash. We were looking around how to raise it. So,
and that's where Nambri came in.
Correct. we'd gone up and down Collins Street talking to the various investment bankers, and they'd sort of basically said, we want your firstborn, secondborn and security. We want 50% of the company. We want dilution rights, converting notes. And we went, God, we'll own nothing if this is the case. And then Bruce came up with the idea that Nambri,
Bruce Carter,
it had $6 million Nambri in it. And so, and it was just a listed box. And we went, right, let's do a reverse takeover.
And you weren't big enough to do just a clean skin, as we called it in the game, where you just list the company like an IPO?
Not big enough. Plus also, you know, IPOs need a long prospectus. We could do a short form, which meant you didn't have to put out a forecast. So that, I think, is what kills most startups, is having to do a full prospectus, put out five-year forecasts, when really you don't know on a new startup mostly how that
you don't know
look.
When you're established what you're going to do. 100%.
It's so true. So we could do a short form prospectus, took the $6 million and that kept us going.
And do you remember the price that you vended the business in at?
2 cents.
2 cents a share.
2 cents a share.
So my, and there hasn't been any reconstruction of the share capital since?
So yeah.
A split or a consolidation?
We did a 1 for 10, that got us to 20 cents. Then the share drifted down to 9 cents. And really we were a private listed then, and then 2012, we were at 9 cents. We took a 20% discount and raised the equity in 2012 at 7 cents, then did a 1 for 10, and then that's it. So it's gone from really 70 cents to whatever it trades today.
Very good. So you've vended into there, then you've got some money. You've got this $6 million. And what do you do with that?
Went and bought two more sites. So
they were your second and third sites?
Yep, Tarnese and Warragul. We were off again. And then again, of course, you start running out of money again. And actually Telstra Super stepped in and gave us a $50 million note, effectively subjugated under the banks. It was almost non-balance sheet, but at a 13% coupon. So it was expensive, but it was not equity. I think...
So not dilutive to your ownership?
No. So it was a gift in a way. But it was expensive at 13%, so...
1.3.
Yes, right. 13%.
For a moment, I thought you said 30. And no, I'm thinking, 13. What world are you living in?
That's 1.3. Right. And I think the other part of starting businesses, when I'm doing seminars on this, it's a race to retain your equity. You know, once you go through a Series A, Series B, Series C, Series D, all dilutive, how you actually retain your equity, I think, is one of the hardest challenges in a startup.
And as you've gone along, you mentioned the capital raise in 9, then 12, and then more recently. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
But the cadence of how you've developed villages has accelerated.
Yes. So
the first one lasted for, sounds like, 3 or 4 years, and then you did two. And you did two for a while on the go, and then it's gone to 3. Is that right?
That's correct.
And now you could be stepping up even further.
Correct. So fast forward, it took 12 years to do, going from one new community a year or site per year to develop, we're greenfield only, to getting to 3 in 2024. And so thus, fast forward, the fundraise that we announced on to raise $275 million last Thursday, fully underwritten, that was about putting the business into the next level of step change. Even though we'd said for 12 years we wouldn't raise equity, we've managed to see a line of sight of sort of 5 pieces of land that we could buy. So once we, and that's on top of our BAU of doing 3 sites a year, so that's given us this ability to then step change the business for the next 12 years.
And I gather for you in this period now, it was a real tug of war in your own mind, because you said we recycle the capital, we can grow up this cadence, but all of a sudden there's 5 very attractive sites that come on.
Yes.
And you've got to make up your mind, can we fund these?
Yeah.
And go back to the equity market. Is that a fair statement?
Exactly. So we had bought our 3 sites for the year, as our cadence is new 3 new sites a year, quite early in the financial year. And then we saw a 4th, and it was a good site. And so we redid the deal with the bank and refied that. And we're on cycle to actually do that. So we increased funding there to pick up the 4th. And then we saw a 5th, a 6th, a 7th, an 8th. And we're going, oh my God, there's land coming out of the market like we haven't seen for a very, very long time. And so we sort of slept over at Christmas knowing we'd maxed out the credit card to buy anything. And then, yeah, Darren and I got together and
Darren's your CFO.
Our CFO, and he sort of did the Darren's Burger dress, and it was sensational. And And I had this sort of moment of recollection, Matthew, you've known this business for a very long time. But as a founder also, you know, the danger is you keep going with these mantras that we're not raising equity and blah, blah. And it took me a while to adjust the fact that actually we should be raising equity. Like, you need to change, you need to flip, you need to actually move on. And I'm also mindful, you know, I'm not here forever either. So the responsibility to do that sits with me, not with anyone else. And if a new CEO came in someday and immediately first thing they did was raise equity, the whole market would just, you know, wouldn't understand it. So
I think that's my responsibility. It's good to have philosophies, but you've also got to be flexible.
100%.
Because opportunities arise.
It's so true.
Which can further the business down the track.
It's so true, Matthew. And I think, you know, you can always have a plan, but there's a better plan. You should look at the better plan.
Well, it sounds like a couple of times you've listened to outside people for good advice. In those early days, you needed annuity income.
Yep.
That wasn't the property mentality.
Yep.
And then now again, recently, your CFO's telling you, no, if we're going to do this, you've got to change tack and we've got to do this.
And
you
know, I've got
to raise the equity.
I approached a few of my mentors external and helped and guided me and some of my ex-board members from way back. And, you know, one of them said to me, you know, what you were doing back in 2012 when it was a cottage industry is very different to where you are today. You're close to a $2 billion business. You've got a sector now that's been institutionalized and is now an asset class. So why wouldn't you use the market if you see an opportunity to actually do that? And that was a gear shift in my thinking.
And tell me about how that's been a response. Your share register's changing?
So, yeah, we've gone long on the register. So we're now seeing more super funds come on the register.
And they want long-dated assets.
They want long-dated assets, correct. Yeah, we've had 25% EPS growth over the last 12 years, and that's highly attractive. They just want to see that keep moving forward, and it's the long-date nature of that. Plus, I think there is a component of that sits within the ESGs around creating affordable housing, and it is a business for purpose. So there is sort of some tick box around that, I think, that as well. But, you know, putting the commercial hat on, yeah, it's a long-dated play.
It's not what you were thinking of in 2003 in the cafe.
Definitely not. No, would we ever be?
It's a monumental shift because you've got long-term income streams of property.
Yes.
Which banks, I would think, are dying for now. But also these superannuation funds around the world, these pension funds who need those assets.
Correct. I think that's that inflection point really was about 2018 when I think particularly the super funds sort of woke up to what this asset class was about. And we start to see more come onto the register. And then obviously, you know, we've got a big super fund who sort of has quite a big stake now.
So paint the picture into the future as best as you can. It's always hard. You've got these five properties, I think you've declared, that you're interested in negotiating on.
Yep.
And that's that step change.
Yep.
Because you've got 30-odd already out there that you've finished or working on. 15 years down the track, is it all Victorian? Is there 100 properties? What's the capacity for the model you've got?
Great question. So because the penetration rate of this sector of land lease into the addressable market is probably 2% and less. Plus the generations are changing. Gen X is here as well. For lifestyle, we've been in Victoria for 20 years and I can't see a reason at this stage to move out of Victoria because we've got such a low saturation rate of these communities compared to New South Wales and Queensland. And I think the customer base will always be looking for an option to downsize. I think that just goes with whether it's downsizing to free up equity or downsizing to free up time, which is more what the Gen X looking at. You go to then the Gen Y and the Gen Z millennials. I can't see that story changing. I think we have a 30-year plan to improve every community unit. So it's every 5 years we're ripping out all the carpets and chairs. Every 10 years we're ripping out the bathrooms. And so it leaves the business in good state to say that we'll see constant improvement amongst the asset base. Obviously, our reward for doing that over the next 15 years is that we we'll get the benefit of our deferred management, which we now call deferred management benefit, of taking up to 20% of the resale price of the home. So that means that we're very vested in running, sort of co-invested actually with our homeowners to make sure we look after these communities and create the highest capital growth we possibly can for reselling homes. And that's been now over the last 10 years about 9.5%. capital growth on resales.
And going back to those conversations a bit earlier where the market wasn't finding its feet, everyone was circumspect about it. The people who have lived in your villages and have now moved on for whatever reason, are they happy with their experience, do you think? Do you think you've ticked that box?
Yes.
Did you solve that problem?
Yes. So so we say our sales consultants aren't actually selling a home. And I look at new entrants to the market and they're sort of trying to say in the first appointment, do you want to buy a house? And that's a bit soon. You want to say, let's have dinner first and ask me that question. But really it's about changing lives. You know, so basically what our homeowners are looking for, they've got a need that they want to change something. Single females have a whole collection of that. Couples have a whole collection of that. And so our top gun salespeople are the ones who are really good at spending the first 2 hours in a conversation understanding what they're trying to change in their lives, and then we can match that and then sell them a home. And so for the most rewarding thing for me, Matthew, is getting out amongst the community, I call it community therapy, just talking to homeowners, and they all go, should have done 10 years ago, or where'd you get this idea? It's changed my life. And that, for me, ticks my ethical, social and moral sustainability mandate that we started with to say, yeah, we're doing good, and we're doing real good in some cases. So,
because people aren't really moving that far generally, are they?
No.
That's why you're on those growth corridors on the outskirts of Melbourne. Because people like to stay in their general community, whether it be family, friends, but they're living in a new place, in a community that provides their social needs.
Yeah, and Australians are incredibly sedentary because 80% of people live within 15 kilometres of where they moved up, which is the absolute flip in America. So we like to stay stum. So, our communities sit very much within that space of 80% of our homeowners come from within 15 kilometres.
You've had to grow a big business and you still sit at the top of that business with how many employees have you got?
200 employees now.
200. That's a big business. How do you think you've gone as a manager and how do you think you've developed?
I think I'll go back one tack. I mentioned to you that I didn't enjoy working at Lendlease, and I always thought that, if I saw my boss at Lendlease, I'd go blah, 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 and that was the worst experience of my life and all the rest of it. And I was asked to a UDA conference to talk about, did I have any, what would I have done differently in my career? And the reality is, if I'd never done the Lendlease gig and seen what my view of management at its almost very worst, the table thumping, the yelling, which was the sort of culture of that business sort of post Dick Dusseldorf all those years ago, I wouldn't have learnt that that's not a management style I like. So that helped hone my skills as a leader going forward. So, anyone I mentor, I say, do lots of things. So they're all going to teach you lots of different things and then pull that together at the end, and that's the leader you're going to be. It's those experiences and what you learnt from them. So I think as a leader now, and it's a bigger business again, I just sort of still lean into those same principles of, we're a highly consultative, engaged, empowered culture, very flat, always looking to, with curiosity and sort of this own-it, sort of mentality of just getting stuff done for customers and homeowners and our team sort of sets you up pretty well in the sort of safe side of leadership. And then to me, I think the greatest leadership trait I can think of is kindness, actually. I think Lifestyle is a very kind organisation, and we look after our people and very kind with our people, but therefore we're also very kind with our homeowners. So that, to me, if I had to say what's one leadership trait I enjoy most, is kindness.
The kind CEO.
The kind CEO.
There's a book in that for you. I'd be remiss to say everyone in Australia probably talks about housing, and you're obviously in a segment of that and done very well, and it's got a great future. What would you say about affordable housing in Australia, and are there solutions? Because it seems like it's a national crisis now. It's not just in Melbourne where you operate, but generally. Do you see any solutions? It takes a long time to develop the supply. There's a lot of demand.
It's a multi-planked solution, I think. And the piece that we play is, if you think that 63%, I think, of people over 50 own detached housing, the detached housing in Australia, they're mostly empty nesters. They're creating this logjam. So the recycling of housing to first home buyers is not occurring as quickly as it should. I think in Australia every night we have 12 million empty bedrooms, which speaks volumes to this empty nester challenge that Australia's got. For a long time we prosecuted, when I was chair of the Residential Land Lease Alliance, that we should have a last home buyer's grant. We know that first home buyer's grants typically go into the builder's pocket, when the governments hand those out when there's a downturn in housing. But a last home buyer's grant, actually encouraging people to get out of their homes, downsize, free up that housing stock for the next generation, and it's mostly at the more affordable end.
Because people don't like to leave their home, do they?
Correct.
That's hard work.
Correct. And I think one of the biggest things that keep people in their home is sort of the kids' age, kids' heights that is sort of scored into the door jamb of the laundry when, you know, Simon was five, his height. You know, there's so many memories that sort of are imprinted into a piece of property. So, you know, how you... in fact, the Buddhists have got this great expression, Matthew, which is possessions possess. And why do possessions possess? They shouldn't. You know, that's something that's immaterial. It hasn't got an emotion. It hasn't got anything else. It's you're imprinting your emotions on that asset or that piece of furniture or that book or whatever it is to say, oh, therefore, I've got an emotional connection. No, you don't. It's really interesting when you're next downsizing, Matthew, and you're going through the stuff and you remember that, you know, Buddhist expression. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. Our biggest competitor really is people staying stum. That's our biggest competitor.
You talk about me. I was on the drive to sell our place because we're virtually an empty nester ourselves now, being in that zone. And after about 2 months of looking at places, my wife said, I like my home and so do our dogs. I'm staying here. So I know what it's like trying to sell the idea.
You're in all sorts of trouble.
Final question from me. I mentioned cheekily at the start in the introduction that you're at that age where you could move into the lifestyle community's accommodation now. How do you feel? You in your mid-60s, plenty of energy, just done a big capital raise.
100%.
New development stage.
Bring it on. it's so exciting. And what I'm really excited about is this reimagination of our product, reimagination of the offer for the Gen X, and then reimagine of all our touch points and our whole service stream around catering for the Gen X. And that's just got me so up and about and so engaged, because I think if we can crack that, that's a huge opportunity for lifestyle moving forward, and also for the sector if you can get it right. In fact, in my own life, I've moved to a suburb of Melbourne called Albert Park, and that is a community. That's the biggest thing I can find in inner Melbourne that really almost mirrors what we're doing with lifestyle communities. Everyone says hello, everyone's sort of the same age. You know, it's a bit pricey, so you've got to be a bit older to live there. It's got this great sort of spirit to it. So I'm kind of living in a lifestyle community, but not out in the burbs, but rather in Albert Park. Yeah, no, I love what I do. It's been a great passion for 21 years, and as long as everyone will still have me, and if my leadership team don't boot me out saying, you know, get lost, you're getting in the way, as long as I can keep staying in front of them, I hope to keep doing this for a while.
Yeah, you might celebrate a few more birthdays.
Happy, absolutely.
Well, congratulations on turning 21. It's been a terrific story, and we look forward to the next chapter in the journey.
Thank you, Matthew.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.